This is Ken Blakelock, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 22nd of June 2013. Ken Blakelock, Part 2.
Well, because while I was on the Dorsal in 55, I heard about Bunny's plans for TAE, so I immediately sent him a message saying, don't forget me.
So you asked him rather than the other way around?
No, I asked him not to forget me. So when I got back, of course, I had quite a lot of work to do at the Director of Overseas Survey, but Bunny invited me to be the leader of the advance party, whose purpose really was to, of course, build the base. So in the preparation up to leaving on the ship, I really wasn't involved very much because I had quite a lot of work at the DOS, the Director of Survey. So it was only just before the ship sailed that I really got to know everybody who was coming with me. Mm-hmm. But again, the ship sailed, the usual collection, but of course on board were not only Bunny, I'm thinking of Antarctic people, but Ralph Lenton, whom I mentioned earlier, was with the advance party, and myself, and also Roy Homard, who had been on the British North Greenland expedition, so he had polar expedition from the north. So there were of the advance party, three people who were had past experience. And Bunny's idea was to get a member of the Commonwealth who could send representatives. Hannes Grange was the South African, and he was on the advance party. But the George Lowe, of course, was a New Zealander. John Stevenson was the Australian. Canada declined partly because it was coincided with the IGI, the International Geophysical Year, and they had so much work to do in the north that they couldn't spare anything. So Canada wasn't representative, which was slightly sad. But as well as that, there were British people, of course, Ross, George Marsh, who of course was my base leader, and another surveyor, whose name I've forgotten, but I don't remember.
And your purpose was to establish base camp?
The main purpose was to build a hut.
South of Halley?
Oh, yes. Well, we didn't know at the time. When we got to South Georgia, of course, after the aircraft were constructed, the smaller aircraft, and we sailed south, and for the first period, we had very easy passage. Now, the Weddell Sea had been penetrated by Weddell, I don't know, in 18-something or other, and he was the farthest south, nearly almost due south. Most of the later people, like Bruce and Shackleton, had gone a bit farther east and hit the coast of Antarctica quite a long way northeast of Halley. But, of course, we went too far. It's in hindsight, it's easy to see what we should have done, but we got stuck. And we were stuck there for over a month, I think, before we could be released, because we had to go northwards again to get out of it and then come round. And, of course, the Halley Bay base was organised by the Royal Society. Totten got there actually to Halley Bay before we did, even though she left 10 days later. But, of course, there was some consideration as to whether we should build Shackleton at Halley Bay, but Bunny and two others flew inland. And as proved later, and Alan will know, it was chaotic. It was almost impassable, even for dog sledges. I don't know how long it took, how many years it took to find a route, but it was a long time, wasn't it?
The route was found in 1960, I suppose.
Yeah, and this was 1957. So you can see, Halley Bay, and of course it was farther north, and the ideal, of course, was to get as far south. So Bunny, Bunny continued on the hope that we would find something in the Filcher Shell House.
And he was determined to go as far south as possible.
Because it shortened the journey.
Yeah.
And the chances are the coast shelf ice tends to have often better inland access than land ice.
Mm.
And we found, of course, the site for Shackleton. But, of course, we're over a month late. I don't know about the dates now, but there was a bit of a panic to get everything unloaded, 400 or 500 tons of stuff, and get us established. And I chose the site about a mile and a half inland, in fact, and the stores were starting to be taken up there. But most of the stores were put on what's called bay ice. It's sea ice, which has been there for a number of years and assumed to be a bit thicker and tougher than ordinary sea ice. And on one of the flights when I was flying in to look inland just to see what the surface was like with Gordon Haslock, we were told to turn back because the actual ocean where the vessel was, the Sea One was starting to freeze over. And the skipper was very concerned. And so they left us, the eight of us, in a fairly precarious state because they had to get out of the Weddell Sea.
And Fuchs went back on the ship, didn't he?
Oh, yes, Fuchs went back on the ship.
Leaving you in charge.
That's right, yes.
With half a hut.
Well, no. Well, the hut was all in pieces, of course. No hut at all. We had a box about this size of the room, which we used as a house to start off with, which was the crate to which the snowcat came in. But we were only eight people, and, you know, it's amazing how little labour you have. Three of us, when I think the ship left, three of us who'd been down, I suspect the other two had the same. We knew we were going to have a hard winter, but we didn't realise how hot it was going to be, really. Because we started work. Two people generally were bringing stores up from the pile on the bay ice. Two people were doing the cooking and cleaning and such like with the dogs. Two people were working on the start of the base foundations of the hut. And two people were just at general maintenance of the vehicles. So you can see, we started the hut. And over the next few weeks, we brought out all the food, all the hut, except for a few pieces, a limited amount of fuel, and various other items. But in mid-March, I think it was about, we had appalling weather, a blizzard lasting 8 days, or 5 days, I can't remember, a very long, which we just lived in the snowcat. We used the snowcat crater as a living place, but we actually camped in tents. And after the blizzard, started work again, and two of us, Tony Stewart and myself, went down to look at. Fortunately, we brought the dogs up beforehand. We looked at there, we could see a water sky, you know, which is an indication that some of the sea ice has gone out. And when we got there, of course, most of the stores had disappeared. There were sort of 40-gallon drums perched like that on the edge. So most of the fuel, and a lot of it was fuel, of course, because, you know, vehicles use a vast amount, but all the upper air met gear, some of the building gear, various other bits and pieces were lost. And it was with some dismay I came back and told the others. And I said, we could go and stay with the Argentines. There's a base about 50 miles away. We could. I don't know whether the American base was there or not, I can't remember, but basically I said, I think really we want to try and continue on.
Mm.
The only thing we were short of is in hindsight, it's always easy to say, I should have brought more fuel up. But we had 3 gallons a day, we worked out, for cooking, lighting and heating, of course. It was a minimum, but it was just about adequate. And we had started building the hut, and we continued to do so. The temperatures are now, of course, once you get past March, you're into start of winter, you know, the temperatures are getting lower, the daylight was getting shorter because we were well south of the Antarctic Circle. And one of the blizzards, we got some of the panels on of the hut. It filled with snow. We don't know how much, but we estimated 80 tonnes of very hard packed drift snow. So a lot of our time was just spent digging out the hut, as well as building it, continuing. But we actually dug tunnels and we kept the dogs in, so it had a dual purpose. But the temperatures in the tents were pretty grim. Again, looking back, I think we can clearly say that it was probably the hardest, most difficult year in modern times of any party. I'm not saying it's worse, it's not as bad as, say, Roman Police's one, Disappointment Island and such like, or various other people who've been marooned. But it was a very tough one.
Because of the lack of fuel, because of the...
Not so much the lack of fuel. We couldn't heat the hut, because in any case, so the fuel was manageable. We had enough fuel for heating the tents, lighting and cooking. So it wasn't the lack of fuel, it was the low temperatures.
Unexpectedly low.
No, I mean, at those latitudes you do get low temperatures, but, you know, a minus 65 in the tents, and we're in tents, not... I mean, minus 65 in a normal hut, of course, it's very unpleasant to go outside, but in a hut you usually have a bit higher temperature.
But was it the plan to have the hut finished in time for winter? Or was that never going to
happen?
If
we'd been
a
month earlier, yes, we would have finished.
So the reason it was a bad winter was because the ship was late coming
in. Oh, yes, that's right, yes. Okay. And, of course... If the ship had been got there in January, we would not only have had all the TAE people, but we had all the crew as well. Mm-hmm. And clearly, they would have got all the stores up onto the land ice.
So the mistake that caused the problem was...
Getting stuck. Yes. Yeah. Again, in hindsight, we should have gone a bit farther east, but the next year, the Megadang got stuck even going farther east. But it was the delay that caused... the main problems. And it was a very grim winter, but we were very busy. You know, there's always workplace to do. And in the end, we finished the hut. We had done some exploratory survey. We'd done we started Met going very early. And I think we had achieved all that could be expected of us. In fact, I did mention that. I said, you know, Amanda asked, what was the best achievement? And I think the best achievement was the fact that the members of the advance party carried out all that was required of them under extreme conditions. But, of course, obviously, we did start living in the hut, only a small portion of it, because it still had to be heated either by wood, but we got everything fixed. Mm. And the hut wasn't completely finished, but there were odd things. But when the Megadang came in, they were soon completed. And the second year, of course, was completely different for me. The plan had been for Hal Lister, who was on British North Greenland, to establish a plateau hut well inland at about 3,500 feet up, 300 miles inland, to study glaciology. And the requirements were all flown in by aircraft. And John and I and Hal spent a very pleasant winter there. It was a comfortable little hut. Two other good companions. The only incident that happened was we often had to wait for the aircraft to bring more stores in. So we were waiting for things to do to build it. We'd nearly completed the hut when Gordon flew in on a beautiful day.
Gordon
Haslop, the pilot, came in with the Otter for another load quite early in the day and said, "It's a brilliant day. I reckon I can do another flight." Two flights, it was the only time it was achieved. And so John Stevenson asked Buddy, could he go and visit the Witchaway Nunataks, which was about 30 miles north of us, to do some geology, because he was actually a geologist more than a glaciologist. And Buddy said yes, so we bundled in a standard tent, a little sledge, 2 gallons of fuel, which is the normal sledging, and 10-day box of food, and landed at the Witchaways, expecting to be about 2 or 3 hours there. So we put up the tent, had a cup of tea, and immediately dashed out. And the arrangement had been that we had a radio which could listen to transmissions from the base. We couldn't transmit back. So they told us the news, and we acted on that. And at 6 o'clock, they said, "Well, the weather's deteriorated a bit. There won't be a second flight." Okay, so you wait. By the fourth day of bad weather, and we were having certain bad weather as well, they were a bit concerned, and I decided we'd better go on half rations. Now, it was still quite cold, but half rations inside a tent don't really affect you too much. We're getting a bit of frostbite, but nothing severe. By the eighth day, we only had 4 days' food left, because obviously the 4 days, only used 2 days. And I was getting a bit concerned, shall we say. I think the base was as well. And you know objectively that the best thing is to stay where you are, because your food will last longer. But you never know when the plane's coming. It still might come in 20 days' time, and you're dead, you know. Well, you could. So I decided to start walking, man-holding. We had a tent, this rather immature sledge, and 4 days, we nearly full, and half a gallon of petrol, power thing. The surface, the temperatures were in the minus 40s, but the wind was fairly strong. Fortunately, I had taken a bearing when I was at South Ice. We couldn't see the Nunataks, but about a mile away I took taken a bearing, so I knew the bearing to come back on. But the problem with two-man hauling is if one man stumbles, you stop. You know, Scott had, say, five. If one man stumbles, the four could continue on until the fifth man comes in, but not with two. So I felt that we weren't quite getting our 8 miles a day, which was what we required. And on the 12th day, I thought we were perhaps out of the 32 miles estimated, we were probably 20-something. And that evening, on the 12th night, it was a beautiful day, calm, brilliant sunshine. And I said to John, because John had never sledged before, and this was a fairly harsh
baptism. Yeah.
I said to John, if the plane doesn't come tomorrow, we'll abandon the tent, take our sleeping bags, and ski, because that was the only hope we ever had of getting, because we had no food. I mean, the last bit of food was a rather fatty rush of bacon and a biscuit, you know, and a cupful of fuel. So you just plan to do that. You don't think of the consequences. Fortunately, of course, the plane came. After a couple of flights, it took quite a little while for them to find us because, you know, a tent is a very small thing, really. They found us, we got on board. John had a fair amount of frostbite, but not serious, just painful. Mm-hmm. And we got sent back to Shackleton all well. It was only in hindsight, 20 years later, that you realised it was a damn close thing, really.
That was a pretty close call, was it?
It was a pretty close. I realise now it was the closest I got to being dead, in fact. Because the problem was not during the next few miles, it was when we couldn't see the Witchaways. Mm. And all that was snow-capped was an odd mast or two and and a little chimney. So it might have been quite difficult to find it. So, but in any case, that didn't come in. I spent a very happy 6 months at South Eyes.
South Eyes, just so I get my facts right, that was the base, that was a starting point for the TOE, was it, South Eyes?
Well, no, obviously Shackleton was really the starting point, because obviously the vehicles were at Shackleton.
So what was South Eyes? That was the first stop?
One of the main stops, yes.
Yeah.
But there was trouble long before that. So when I'd flown back to the base, the plan was for the vehicles to have an advance journey, distance unknown, but hopefully getting to South Eyes. Meanwhile, the aircraft flew four of us into the Shackleton Mountains for survey and geology. And this is what Amanda asked, what attracts a surveyor there?
Hmm.
It's impossible now, but in the 1950s, you could discover a range of mountains, like the Shackletons, I don't know, 150 miles long, who'd never been seen before. You start literally with a blank piece of paper. Mm. And not many surveyors can have that luck to do. You know, right from the very start, you've got to position everything. So that's the interest at that time.
But this was, for want of a better phrase, filling in time before the Transantarctic Expedition began, presumably. Set off.
Well, yes, before the journey began, yeah. The TA started when the advance party was there.
Were you involved with the actual journey?
Oh, yes, of course, I travelled right across.
You did the whole transit?
Virtually all of it. For some reason, I'll tell you the last bit I didn't, but that was a reason.
So how many people were actually in that party?
Well, all of us. Right. All of us. The base was left empty.
Okay. You know.
The only four people who were left, you might say, were the four RAF people, and they flew the Otter all the way across to McMurdo. So everybody, that was the only exit. There was no ship planned to visit Shackleton again to pick anybody out.
Right.
No, everybody had to leave. and, of course, this advance vehicle journey found terrible troubles at the Recovery Glacier and took much longer than to get through than planned. And then, of course, they came back. And then the journey started with everybody from Shackleton. There were the four snow cats, three weasels. I said a menagerie of odd animals, four cats, three weasels, a bombardier, and all the men. The dogs had actually been flown to South Ice, so they started their journey from South Ice.
What do you remember of that departure? What were your spirits like?
Chaotic. No, chaotic. But say, well, we are really on their way, you know, because we knew that basically there was no turning back, and so it was all looking ahead. The first part of the journey was over the lower part of the shelf ice, was not much problem. It was when we were getting onto the land ice that the trouble started, especially across the Recovery Glacier, where the vehicles were breaking the crevasses because we were a bit later. Again, if we'd been a month earlier, the crevasses would have been bridged more securely. And the first one, the cat just seemed to lean over a bit with a great hole. It took us a long time to learn how to get it out. But the final one, the worst one, was where the cat was perched with rear pontoons on one edge of the crevasse and the other two pontoons perched on the other side with a hole underneath. And he felt that whichever way you pulled it, you know,
it was going to go down.
You can't hang a snow cat on a bit of wire. This is the advantage of dogs. This is why I'm a dog man. First of all the dogs are ahead of you, 30 feet away, all on individual strands of rope. And if a dog falls down a crevasse, all the others scatter, so you immediately stop. So you're probably 10 metres away from the crevasse itself. And it's fairly easy to pull a dog up, because he weighs 50, 80, 100 pounds, and you usually get a dog up. And if the harnesses are made to fit the dog, usually, they don't slip out of the harness. But a four-ton cat is a bit of a different kettle of fish.
How did you get it back?
Well, when I saw it, I thought, oh, well, we're down to three cats, because I thought, no way. But David Pratt and the engineer had devised, planned beforehand, I mean, it was all experimental, but David Pratt had worked out that what we'd need is some support. And we had long aluminium ladders on the sledges, on the snowcat sledges, and we fitted them underneath the pontoons, which were half hanging down, cut into the edges of the glacier, or the crevasse wall, so that they were in a ledge, in a water like that, and wires to dead men to hold them, at least if they jumped out. Two of these underneath, and the crevasses were sort of ellipse shape. They were wide in places, but narrowed somewhere else, and so you could find a place where the cats could get over safely. So we got two cats on one side, south of on the way we're going, one cat in the crevasse, one cat behind as an anchor. And David was in charge and told the two front cats to slowly pull forward. And of course, the snow cat jumped, the pontoons fell onto the bridges. The rear cat was, of course, just holding the bridges in and the cats to help if they fell. And the bridges started tilting, or one bridge at least did. And so David shouted to the two, pull, 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 and up it climbed and got out. It was a very good rescue. I mean, it was a jolly hard, but very successful, really.
Was it, generally speaking, was it quite tedious, mile after mile?
The journey, oh yes, it was tedious. I mean, for Surveyor, all he did was, you know, measuring the barometric heights and doing a masto. There wasn't much survey as such, other than guiding the vehicles to go south. The South Pole is quite an easy place to get to. Wherever you start, it's always south.
Yes.
Most geologists and surveyors and even glaciologists like the mountains, of course, because they're much more useful. Certainly.
And did Fuchs lead the way all the way?
Yes. Again, in hindsight, and Rhino commented that not only was the leader, but it was the deputy leader as well. Yes, Bunny led by example. It would have been more simple, of course, to at least have the deputy leader at the back. The most dangerous point, of course, is the first cat. The second most dangerous is the last cat, because as the vehicles go over the bridge crevasse, they start knocking bits of snow off. Mm. So if the first one either falls in or gets across, number two and three get across, and number four's likely to fall in.
So we were in a fairly high state of tension for much of the time in case something like that happened and went wrong.
Well, yes, tension. We were in this very bad crevasse. We actually prodded meticulously mile after mile to find where the crevasses were. Because you could nearly always find a place where, I say, these ellipses were safe, but you didn't want to go on the fine part. Yes, it was very tedious. I mean, we were doing sort of 2 or 3 miles a day, because it takes a long time to keep on prodding for crevasses. But once we reached the Witchaways and South Ice, we were pretty certain that the crevasse wouldn't be a problem, and it wasn't. So when we reached South Ice, John and I took over the dogs. Vehicles take about always so much longer to get ready than the dog team. A dog team can be ready in 5 minutes. And of course, we'd flown over and knew there were no crevasses, but from the air, you can't really tell what the surface is like. So the plan was that John and I left early, ahead of the vehicles, before the vehicles left South Ice, because they did some maintenance and all sorts of things. And we sledged with fairly light loads over what was very heavy sastrugi. And sastrugi are these wind-cut surfaces, and they can be quite high and very bumpy. For a dog sledge, you know, bases are called like ice calcate or snake hips, because they can bend with the light cargo, and the dogs can manage. But the vehicles, of course, have got 2-ton sledges towing, and they've got to be very careful they don't smash the sledges. It's quite easy to bend the sledge. So they were very slow, but they were slowly catching us up. And the difficulty often is to manoeuvre around the crevasses, around the sastrugi, without going off course. So what we did, we built snow cairns. Snow's, it's not like snow here, it's very compact. You use a saw to cut blocks, and we built big white blocks. And they stand out beautifully, clearly, you can see them 5 miles away.
So you're leaving a trail of these cairns?
That's right, yes.
From which you can project your forward direction.
That's right. Yeah. And so the cats didn't need to worry about what distance they were travelling. They could see where they were supposed to be heading, and if they died there, they would get online again. So they were useful. But slowly, of course, they were catching us up. I don't know how many days, 5 or 6 days, we knew on that day, and they would catch us up. So we built a rather special cairn. We built snow henge, as we called it. 3 pillars with a little one, and a long one along the top. And we used to leave rude messages, you know, don't pass go, don't click 200, only 960 miles to go. But when they caught us up, the sastrugi was getting better, or less effective, so we could keep up with the vehicles fairly easily. And of course, we were doing survey, scientific observations en route. Each night, we'd drill a hole with a special ice drill, down to about, I suppose, 10 metres, I don't know, which Hal Lister would look at the cores for glaciological purposes. And then in the morning, Jeff Pratt, the geophysicist, would put explosive in, laying out a pattern of microphones, basically, to record the echo, as well, like an echo sounder. And the speed of the shock wave varies depending on what's underneath. So if you've got snow, it travels at a different speed to rock. And often on the rock, snow-rock contact, we'll send a ray back so we can measure the depth of the ice above the solid rock. And we did this quite across. But then, of course, once we're getting up to halfway to the pole, so we say I don't know what the height was, 5,000 or 6,000 feet, there was beautiful surface for the cats, and they were doing 30 miles a day. Well, dogs driving, you can do 30 miles, but it's at high altitude, cold weather, it's very, very tiring. I mean, we would start off the day perhaps an hour or two before the cats got going altogether. They'd catch us up early afternoon, and we would drag in 2 hours later after they'd camped. It was very tiring.
Once you got onto the higher dome, and the going was easier, were there any more problems then? Did the cats break down, the dogs?
Oh, yes. In fact, probably most of us didn't realise how much maintenance the vehicles had. There were two problems with the cats. The pontoons were covered with bars, not problems, but they had to be tensioned just right, because if they got too loose, they might jump or snap. You could only tense them tightly. You couldn't untense them. So you went around, I think there were 138 bars to do on each cat, each bit pontoon, and you bent to tension them up with a large grip, but you were afraid of over-tensioning, and often they would come and say, no, that's a bit more tension, so I have to go around again. And then grease guns. You imagine what a grease gun in a 10-knot wind does. The grease goes everywhere but where it's meant to. Filthy job. So dog lovers don't really like vehicles. But, yes, there were certain mechanical problems, especially with the weasels, because they were very old. And in the end, we ditched them all. In fact, there were 3 weasels, which were better for hauling than the Bombardier. The Bombardier was a very nice vehicle, but couldn't pull very much. And the plan was, of course, when we had the load that could be distributed on the remaining vehicles, we ditched one. So we ditched the Bombardier, and about 20 miles on, one of the weasels collapsed completely, so we went and picked up the Bombardier again. But in the end, by the time we got to the pole, I think the 3 weasels and the Bombardier had been jettisoned. But the cats could carry the fuel load, not the load of the fuel, because about 90% of it, cargo. Yeah.
So as you, what was the spirit of the men like? I mean, you talk about the machines, the dogs. How are the
men? Well, I mean, it is pretty boring, I must say. but you know, we were doing the way we were planning to do. We really knew it was the only way to go. I think what partly there was one occasion when we heard that Ed Hillary had set off with his tractors. I think we were a bit dismayed at what most of us considered a bit disloyal. He knew that he was risking everything because the tractors could only the focus and tractors weren't designed really for high altitudes. They pulled a fairly small load, and he only just made the hole before his fuel ran out. And of course, he was completely dependent on the Americans to be flown out again. He had no way he could get back. The view of the Englishman at the base, as Voss Base, George and Marsh, was that there were three expeditions at Voss Base. The TAE one, the IGI one, which was the New Zealand Antarctic one, and Ed Hillary's plan. I have no proof that he thought about it earlier. I suspect he had this idea long before it actually occurred. And to my mind, it was quite a great achievement, but it was slightly disloyal to Bunny. And so that's why I think most of the British TAE were not widely happy with Ed. George, of course, George Lowe, who was a very close friend of Ed's, an average climber, of course, was in a very invidious position, of course, because he knew how we felt, and yet, of course, he really wanted to be loyal to his friend. And in passing, I think Ed rather had a chip on his shoulder. And
how do you mean?
Well, he thought everybody was against him and had to show himself to be the master. What I think it was amazing is the work he did in not climbing Everest. He was a very powerful climber, and he was lucky, I'd say, because George Lowe, if Ed and Tenzing had failed, George Lowe would be the next one to try. And Ed wasn't the first one, they had tried before, I think. But he then went back to Nepal and did incredible work for a very poor country. Mm-hmm. And that's the sort of, I mean, he was obviously proud of climbing, who wouldn't be climbing Everest? But what he should be known for is his superb work in Nepal. My daughter actually now married a Nepali climber, and he's worshipped as a god in Nepal for magnificent work he's done, health-wise,
yeah.
Medication, teaching and such like. It really was superb.
As you approach the pole, is it true that you were the first dog team to
get
there
since
Amundsen?
Yes,
since 1912?
Yes, of course. As we approached the pole, the Americans had asked us not to go on a certain longitude because they were doing glacial research, so we veered around. And I realised it was basically... I mean, the dogs, of course, were very excited because they could see something ahead of them before... And we the dogs were going mad. We nearly rushed to first, but I thought it was proper that Bunny should go be the first cat to go. So he was the first. But we were the first dogs to drive from to the pole since Amundsen. But because Ed had wrecked the route, we knew that the dogs weren't really necessary. Mm. So they were flown out. The only disadvantage, he kept very poor records of the traverse. So, and places we could see the trail, but much of it was possibly only a mile away, but we had to do that travel in traverse.
You're talking about the journey north again now, are you?
Going north towards the Mokranjo Sound.
Yeah. And was the second part of the trip as uneventful as the first?
No, more eventful in one sense, because a major part of one of the cats had broken. It was the plate which the pontoons were scribbled on, and it they had to weld. You imagine welding in minus 40, it's not easy.
Yeah.
The second one was Geoffrey Pat used to be in his in the back of the cat studying his records, and clearly had carbon monoxide poisoning. Now, we had a certain amount of oxygen, but at high altitudes, I mean, the doctor was very concerned. And that's the only time Bunny actually asked for help from the Americans, and they were superb. Two C-130s came over. They didn't land, but they picked us up as the source and just parachuted down oxygen bottles, which saved Jeff's life almost certainly.
Jeff
Pratt, the glaciologist.
Right.
The no, not the glaciologist, the radio sonde.
So he was suffering from carbon monoxide?
Carbon monoxide, almost certainly, yes.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is a killer. If I say we kept him alive for... We had a little bit of oxygen, but not knowing enough. And if Alan actually recommended it, he'd flown out, but of course, the Americans didn't really want to land, and don't blame him.
So was he an invalid for the rest of the trip?
No, he recovered.
Yeah.
He recovered. He probably did die a bit earlier than he might have done, but no, he recovered him. I don't know when he could be.
I'm conscious that we need to talk about something else as well.
Yes, okay.
Let's just finish a couple more questions about this, if I may. When it was all over, you went to New Zealand, I think, didn't you?
Oh, yes, of course, yes.
To a special reception there.
Oh, yes.
Lots of speeches?
Yes, the first speech, which was quite a big one, an official one. I know the governor spoke for an hour, the mayor of Wellington spoke for an hour, and there was only half an hour left. Ed spoke for a quarter of an hour, and Ed and Bunny spoke for a quarter of an hour. And my next-door neighbour was New Zealand. He said, I wish they bloody shut up, because we don't want to hear them, we want to hear Bunny and Ed.
And did he not end up meeting the Queen because of this?
Well, when Bunny reached Scott Base, he was informed that he'd been awarded the knighthood. So later on, when we got back, and everybody got the Polar Medal, in fact, I got another bar to my medal, the investiture was a private one, just Bunny being knighted, the Polar Medal's being given out, and there was a little reception. And there was friends, wives and girlfriends were there as well, and the Queen came round, of course, talking to everybody. But not so Prince Philip. He had the four RAF people in the corner, we suspect, telling blue jokes. The Queen was looking daggers at him.
Was there also not a presentation at the Festival Hall?
Yes. Well, I don't know about the Festival Hall. The Royal Geographical Society, where there was a speech, and Bunny was awarded the special medal, which we all got a copy of. And the expedition was still wanting more money, so the arrangement was that for the next month or so, we gave talks to all sorts of people. But any funds, we got all the expenses paid, of course, but mm-hmm. any funds went into the TA coffers.
Paying the debts, mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's a story about at the Festival Hall, Bunny was giving a lecture, and then afterwards the whole expedition was lined up on stage to be introduced to the Queen.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
I can't remember it, but I'm sure it probably was, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that Bunny had written all the names on his hand and then read them out in the wrong order.
Well, I think the occasion was too much of a surprise to note what we were called.
Oh, okay. All right. Let's just spend a few more minutes talking about working with the Belgians.
Well,
how did that come about?
Well, obviously, after every expedition, there are reports to write. And the surveyors usually have 3 or 4 months of work. And then we have a bit of holiday and such like. And I finished my work, and as usual, thinking what am I going to do next? I was still single, but I had a girlfriend. And Bunny told me, and David Stratton, that the Belgian expedition leader had asked Bunny whether there was any TA member who were willing to join them, especially a dog driver. Well, that fitted me like a glove. So it actually was offered to David Sutton, first of all, but David got married and had a job with BP and his career was starting. He didn't want to do it. But I was still playing around with the pole. So I went over to the leader, and it sounded very interesting. And I joined the Belgians. I was the only man who had been to Antarctica. I see the Belgians had the system where the Jolash, the grandson, I think, of the original de Jolash, of the first ship who wintered, had his year, and then Bastan came and completely had a new year. Mm. So, as I used to say, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And we had Tony Vartalme, who had been up in northern Norway. He was a geologist. And, you know, if I asked, could we be flown to the Sorvandanas, which is another range of mountains, a huge range of mountains, I got what I wanted. We had a marvellous time. Very pleasant, very crevasse-free area. And we went up in the first year, we had a winter journey, but we went out in September, and we didn't get back to the base until in the next April, you know, 7 months. In fact, there was so much work we had done, we used to have to stop sometimes just to catch up with all our reports. And marvellous. And I did a triangulation of the whole system. And, of course, when we got back to the base the second year, of course, there was a new team there, a new base leader. But it was, certainly the Belgian one was being the final, also being the final base I went to, was the most enjoyable. I've never eaten so well in all my life.
Never been so...
I had never eaten so well in all my life at the
so
base.
So well.
And there's a fair amount of alcohol around as well. But that's only for winter time.
I mean, were you using the tried and tested survey system for the Belgians, or were there some advantages that were being
made?
No,
the difference was, we obviously navigated partly by compass and traverse, but I was actually doing a triangulation. I was observing, I measured a baseline and expanded it, and then started measuring triangles or detailed geodetic work. So we had a network of fixed points right across much of the survey, and we went back again in the next second year, continued. And we're also doing, unusually, we're doing gravity measurements. Mm-hmm. Gravity is related to varies depending on height, latitude, and surrounding density of the material. But there's some beautiful glasses. With my trig points on two ridges, sorry, of rock, we do a traverse across the glacier, taking gravity measurements. And because ice is less dense than the rock, gravity varies because it's relative to the density. And so you can calculate the depth of the ice because, you know, from the gravity reading, it ought to be at that height on the glacier. Mm-hmm. And there were some beautiful U-shaped valleys you could see. And even one where there was a bit of a crevassing, you could actually see the mountain underneath the quartet. So it was very interesting work, doing this gravity traverse. And 7 years later, we went again in the summertime and we measured some of the stakes. So we got the movement of the glacier as well. So that was very interesting work, I thought.
You promised me you'd tell me what you thought of Bunny Fuchs.
Well, I'd say Bunny was my mentor. I think probably looking, if you can analyse your own character, my attitude is, well, if you find the kitchen too hot, you shouldn't be working. You know, you have to take the rough with the smooth. And you get the best job. You know, get the best job you can present. Bunny, I think, his limitations were, one, he ate food to keep alive and had no interest in the quality of the food. And some of the early fits of food was, at the bases I'm talking about, not the sledging route, was could have been better organised, better designed, so to say. But he was... He would listen to your comments or advice, but he didn't tell you why he objected to them. And he used to come out with announcements, this is the plan, which hurt some people. But I thought, well, if that's ruling, we must carry out to the best abilities. I'm quite close to him personally, socially, but I think he was probably a slightly difficult man to get to know. He had a... It's amazing how little you know of people you spend years with. It was only when his autobiography came that I learned of his father's deep detention, because he was German, in World War II. And it took a long time before... And his mother, of course, was English. It took a long time before they even got released and all their savings returned.
So, sorry, Fuchs's father was...
A German.
Living in Britain.
In Britain, yes.
He was rounded up, was he?
Yes, he was rounded up and put on the Isle of... I think it was the Isle of Man.
The Isle of Man, yes. Detention camp.
Yeah. But he did, Bunny never mentioned this, you know, and... A friend of mine, I went to George Lowe's funeral, and a friend said, you know, could you give us a description of George Lowe? Well, yes, a jolly, very pleasant company, but I really don't know much about him. Because you get very parochial, I think, at the basis, you know. Much more important is, have we got enough dog food, or have I got to do cooking in 3 weeks' time, and such like.
Your description of Fuchs reminds me of descriptions I've read about Scott, where... He was a man who was used to giving orders, and nobody really questioned him terribly much.
Yes. I think Bunny had more experience in what was successful. I mean, you know, it was he who planned the TAE. It was shot down with great emphasis by Brian Roberts at the Scott Polo. I mean, Wordy was his mentor, and it's reputed that when he went to Scott Polo, Brian Roberts was there, where he pointed, that's the enemy. So there was tension amongst the sort of top, but Bunny plan did work. You know, there's nothing like success to say the plan's good. And Bunny estimated 2,000 miles, 100 days. A pretty wild guess, you might say, because he had no idea what the speed was. We covered 2,100 miles in 99 days. You can't get much better than that, I think. That says everything.
Did he ever ball anybody out or lose his rag?
Only a funny incident. We played a joke on him at Shackleton Base. Bunny, of course, was not only leader, but he was leader of the whole expedition. And he used to get, obviously, messages from the governor sent by Bosco, which were sometimes confidential. Now, they used to have a thing called Navy one-time pay, which is almost unbreakable. It's tedious to use, and normally the messages were done by three people. Somebody would do the subtracting, somebody would look up in the book, somebody would write it. But if it was really confidential, Bunny headed it, decode yourself. And we made up a farcical message of what to do. We were going to abandon everything and do something particularly maddening.
Was this at Stonington, in fact?
Yes, at Stonington.
Yeah.
And he came out and read. I said, oh, bloody well tell the governor what I think about it. It's going to be in plain language as well. And he was ranting and raving. I've never seen him so angry. And then he stopped, looked around, because we were all trying not to laugh. Who thought this one up? It was the best funny joke I've ever seen. But that's the only time. It was artificial in the sense that he was angry, but we had caused the anger. he wasn't angry with us.
Could he take a joke?
Oh, yes. We played a number of jokes on him. We had the boat race. He was a mad keen Cambridge man. And on the World Service, of course, they broadcast it. Raymond Dent Glenning, who was a very well-known commentator. And we heard when it was going to be, say, at 3:30, but we told Buddy it was at 2:30. we put on our own show of the Cambridge Bridge. Cambridge did everything wrong, you know, man fell in, the cocks got on the wrong end of the boat, they were pulling crabs, and we finally sank the boat. Buddy was tearing his hair out. Oh, what has happened, he said.
But this was a fake commentary.
It was a fake commentary. Yeah. He had a last laugh because Cambridge won by 4 lengths, I think. But he played jokes on other people as well, especially one of the perpetrators of the... No, he could take a joke.
When was your last trip south?
Well, that was in the 1990s, on the cruise ships. Bernard Stoneshouse had been given a grant to study the effects of tourism on the environment. So he would be measuring the size of the moss banks and how many were the penguins being disrupted and such like, were the less. But he had no maps, big enough scale, so he asked me to go. So I had 3 years, each about a month.
Coming down?
As a free holiday. And I produced large-scale maps. As Bernard said, going down the Normea Channel, which goes up, it's one of the most beautiful channels in the West Peninsula. This is the way to see Antarctica, on a comfortable ship with a gin and tonic in your hand. And I saw a lot more of the peninsula than most I'd ever seen before. Most Finns, because they're also called with the cruise ships on all sorts of places.
Your association with the Antarctic is a long period of time, isn't it? So you must have seen a complete revolution in the way things work down there.
Well, as I've noted, I think the biggest change is communications. You know, normally we got mail once a year, if we were lucky. There was no voice telephones, sat-navs. It was all done by Morse code, of course. Any radio operator can pick up any message you send, and they were fairly costly as well. So I think that has altered completely the perception. And when I visited Scott Base many years later, and they had, you know, weekly telephones to their wives, girlfriends, and everything. And I think sometimes it produced problems in the sense that they weren't completely isolated, tough, we'll get our messages in a year's time. They were living partly sort of contact in the proper world, and yet in Antarctica with its isolation and problems.
Living in two worlds at once.
Two worlds at once. And I don't think it necessarily brought better happiness. It obviously was better communications all round for the running of the thing. I think the other thing, of course, is certainly in the British ones, there are far fewer of the Finns now winter, because the field parties get flown out in November, December, stay for 3 or 4 months, and then get flown back, like the geologists and glaciologists. Mm-hmm. Much more efficient. But I think it's lost some of the close camera and friends that you used to make when you all stayed all winter all the time. But, as I said, that's just a fuddy-duddy's old-fashioned view.
And they've got women down there now.
And they've got women. You've seen, of course, the Bass...
Bass Club magazine?
Yeah.
Yes.
That will be remembered for hundreds of years, I think. Yeah.
We must explain, this is the front cover of the Bass Club magazine. It's Bob Burton's final edition, which has a bikini-clad lady cavorting with penguins.
Apparently, it's caused quite a hubbub because the new Bass... director, I think, is a female.
Jane Francis. She will be in October.
I think she's caused a bit of agony.
I think there's been a protest note.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, it wasn't arranged by... It was basically America arranged it.
It's a genuine news story.
Yeah.
They were doing a bikini shoot in the Antarctic.
Yeah.
A fashion shoot.
It was a marvellous way for Bob Burton to go out as last editor.
But women generally?
Well...
I mean, Fuchs would never have allowed it, would he?
No. He would have been dead against it. And I think it... I've only seen one instance where I saw there were problems. suspect they disappeared in the afternoon. I suspect they had sex, but I don't. That's pure supposition. But the remaining were very upset, and they never spoke to this man, really, except from necessity. He was sent to Coventry, almost, you might say.
Jealousy?
No, I think it upset the camaraderie of the base, probably. Mm. I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. I mean, I wasn't really influenced by it, because I knew in 3 weeks, in a month's time, I'd be back at home with my wife, you know. So it wasn't jealousy in that sense. But, of course, I think it was American Antarctic was asked, what did he miss most? He said temptation. Quite a good answer.
What do you miss most now?
Now?
Do you still yearn for the Antarctic?
You always think you'd just like to go once more, but you know it won't work. You know, you're getting old, you get tired, and I couldn't face the travelling. No, I've had as I commented my last, I've had a wonderful life. I've been very lucky to be able to do it. And if I was young again, I had the opportunity to do exactly the same. The only thing I might have kept better diaries. More accounts.
Ken, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Is it okay?
Very okay.
Okay.